1. A New American Age. The United States, a Western European settler colony in North America, emerged from World War II as by far the most powerful state on Earth. This was a surprise to most Americans and to most of the world. It was a young country. It was only about 100 years previously that the government set up in former British colonies finished incorporating former French and Spanish territories into the new country, giving its leaders dominion over the middle strip of the continent. In comparison, their cousins back in Europe had been conquering the globe for almost 5 centuries. They had sailed around the planet, carving it up for themselves. To say that the United States is a settler colony means that the land was overtaken by white Europeans over the course of several centuries in a way that differed from the way that most countries in Africa and Asia were conquered. The white settlers came to stay, and the native population was excluded, by definition, from the nation they built. In order for the new white and Christian country to take form, the indigenous population had to get out of the way. As every American boy and girl learns, there was a strong element of religious fanaticism involved in the founding of the United States. The Puritans, a group of committed English Christians, did not travel across the Atlantic to make money for England. They sought a place for a purer, more disciplined version of the Calvinist society they wanted to build. One way to put this is that they wanted religious freedom. Another is that they wanted a society that was even more homogeneous, fundamentalist, and theocratic than the one that existed in 17th century Europe. In the late 1700s, the leaders of the British colonies expelled the monarchy in a revolutionary war and created a remarkably effective system of self-governance that exists in slightly modified form today. Internationally, the country came to represent and champion revolutionary democratic ideals. But internally, things were much more complicated. The United States remained a brutally white supremacist society. The consequence of the a priori dismissal of the native population was genocide. Throughout the Americas, from Canada down to Argentina, European colonization killed between 50 million and 70 million indigenous people, around 90% of the Native American population. Scientists recently concluded that the annihilation of these peoples was so large that it changed the temperature of the planet. In the new United States of America, the destruction of the local peoples continued long after the Declaration of Independence from British rule. U.S. citizens continued to buy, sell, whip, torture, and own persons of African descent until the middle of the 19th century. Women were only given the right to vote nationwide in 1920. They could actually do so, however, while the theoretical voting rights granted to black Americans were beaten back by racist terror campaigns and laws that were meant to exclude them from real citizenship. When the United States entered World War II, it was what we would now consider an apartheid society. In that war, however, the better angels of American nature came to the fore. It wasn't always clear that would be the case. In the 1930s, some Americans even sympathized with the Nazis, a hyper-militaristic, genocidal, and proudly racist authoritarian party governing Germany. In 1941, a senator from Missouri named Harry S. Truman said, "If we see that Germany is winning the war, we ought to help Russia. And if that Russia is winning, we ought to help Germany, and in that way, let them kill as many as possible." But when the U.S. did join World War II in an alliance with the British, French, and Russians against the Germans and Japanese, its troops fought to liberate prisoners from death camps and save Western Europe's limited democracies from tyranny. Apart from 500,000 who tragically lost their lives, a generation of American boys came back from that war rightfully proud of what they had done. They had looked an entirely evil system in the face, stood up for the values their country was built on, and they had won. The end of World War II was the beginning of a new global order. Europe was weakened, and the planet was broken into pieces. Three worlds. The second most powerful country in the world in 1945, the Soviet Union, also emerged as a victor in that war. The Soviets were intensely proud, too, but their population had been devastated. Adolf Hitler, the leader of the Nazi Party, despised their left-wing ideology and led a brutal invasion into their territory. Before the Soviets finally pushed them back, at Stalingrad in 1943, probably the turning point in the war, a year before the Americans landed in Europe, they had already suffered catastrophic losses. By the time the Red Army reached Berlin in 1945, occupying much of Central and Eastern Europe in the process, at least 27 million Soviet citizens had died. The Soviet Union was an even younger country than the United States. It was founded in 1917 by a small group of radical intellectuals inspired by German philosopher Karl Marx after a revolution overthrew a decrepit Russian monarchy, ruling over an empire that largely consisted of impoverished peasants, and that was considered backward compared to the advanced capitalist countries of Western Europe, where Marx and Vladimir Lenin, the first Soviet leader, actually thought the World Socialist Revolution was supposed to start. These revolutionaries faced a civil war from 1918 to 1920 and employed what the Bolsheviks themselves called terror to defeat the White Forces, a loose coalition of conservatives, Russian nationalists, and anti-communists who were also engaging in mass murder. After Lenin died in 1924, his ruthless successor, Joseph Stalin, forcefully collectivized agricultural production, built a centrally planned economy, and used mass imprisonment and execution to deal with his real and perceived enemies. Millions died as a result in the 1930s, including some of the original architects of the revolution, and Stalin shifted the official ideology of the international communist movement back and forth to suit his own political needs. But much of the worst of this remained secret. Instead, the Soviet Union's rapid industrialization and subsequent defeat of the Nazis, as well as the fact that it was communists who often resisted both fascism and colonialism, earliest and most forcefully around the world, gave it significant global prestige in 1945. The Soviets became the world's second superpower, but they were far weaker than the United States in every way that counts. By the late 1940s, the U.S. produced a full half of the world's manufactured goods. By 1950, the U.S. economy was probably as big as all of Europe and the Soviet Union combined. As for military strength, the Soviet population had been decimated, and this was especially true for those who could be called on to fight in any war. Even though hundreds of thousands of Soviet women bravely fought the Nazis, the gender imbalance in 1945 drives home the devastation. By 1945, there were only 7 men for every 10 women between the ages of 20 and 29. The U.S. had superior military power and demonstrated the apocalyptic damage it could unfurl from the air when it dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That is what we are talking about when we discuss the First World and the Second World in the years after 1945. The First World consisted of the rich countries in North America, Western Europe, Australia, and Japan, all of which had gotten wealthy while engaging in colonialism. Their leading power, the United States, was late to that game, at least outside North America, but it certainly played. The young United States took control of the Louisiana territories, Florida, Texas, and the Southwest by waging war or threatening to attack. Then, Washington took over Hawaii after a group of businessmen overthrew Queen Liliuokalani in 1893 and gained control of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines in the Spanish-American War of 1898. The Philippines, the second largest country in Southeast Asia, remained a formal colony until 1945, while Cuba moved into the informal U.S. sphere of influence in Central America and the Caribbean, where U.S. Marines intervened a dizzying 20 times at least by 1920, and Puerto Rico remains an imperial limbo to this day. The Second World was the Soviet Union and the European territories where the Red Army had set up camp. Since its founding, the USSR had publicly aligned itself with the global anti-colonial struggle and had not engaged in overseas imperialism. But the world was watching how Moscow would exert influence over the occupied nations of Central and Eastern Europe. And then there was the Third World, everyone else, the vast majority of the world's population. That term was coined in the early 1950s, and originally all of its connotations were positive. The Second World was the Soviet Union and the European territories where the Red Army had set up camp. When the leaders of these new nation-states took up the term, they spoke it with pride, It contained a dream of a better future in which the world's downtrodden and enslaved masses would take control of their own destiny. The term was used in the sense of the Third Estate during the French Revolution, the revolutionary common people who would overthrow the First and Second Estates of the monarchy and the clergy. Third did not mean third rate, but something more like the third and final act. The first group of rich white countries had their crack at creating the world, as did the second, and this was the new movement, full of energy and potential, just waiting to be unleashed. For much of the planet, the Third World was not just a category, it was a movement. In 1950, more than two-thirds of the world's population lived in the Third World, and with few exceptions, these peoples had lived under the control of European colonialism. Some of these countries had managed to break free of imperial rule in the 19th century. Some earned their independence when fascist forces retreated at the end of World War II. Some attempted to do so in 1945, only to be reinvaded by First World armies. And for many others, the war had changed little, and they were still unfree. All of them inherited economies that were far, far poorer than those in the First World. Centuries of slavery and brutal exploitation had left them to fend for themselves and decide how they would try to forge a path to independence and prosperity. The simple version of the next part of this story is that newly independent countries in the Third World had to fight off imperial counterattacks and then choose if they would follow the capitalist model favored by the United States and Western Europe, or attempt to build socialism and follow in the footsteps of the Soviet Union, hopefully moving from poverty to a position of global importance just as quickly as the Russians had. But it was more complicated than that. In 1945, it was still possible to believe they could be friendly with both Washington and Moscow. A Vietnamese man named Ho Chi Minh, who had previously worked as a photo retoucher in Paris and as a baker in the United States, embraced revolutionary Marxism after he blamed the Western capitalist powers for refusing to acknowledge Vietnamese sovereignty at the Versailles Peace Conference following World War I. He became an agent for the Communist International before he led the Viet Minh resistance movement against the Japanese occupation in the 1940s. But when he arrived at the Ba Đình Flower Garden in downtown Hanoi after the two nuclear strikes on Japan by the U.S. to declare independence on August 17, 1945, he opened with the following words: "All men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." This immortal statement was made in the Declaration of Independence of the United States of America in 1776. In a broader sense, this means all the peoples on earth are equal from birth. All the peoples have a right to live, to be happy and free. He was celebrating the revolutionary ideals that America's founding fathers had bequeathed to the USA and that its leaders still deeply believed in. He was trying to tell the world that the Vietnamese only wanted what any other people wanted, that is, the right to govern themselves. He was also trying to survive in a very desperate situation. The French colonial army was on its way back to assert white rule over Indochina, and he knew that the last thing he needed was the most powerful country in human history also committed to crushing his independence movement. He was appealing directly to the stated values of the American people, just like many other leftists around the Third World did at the time. After all, the United States had allied with the Soviet Union against Hitler. For the powerful men in that nation's capital, however, things were changing very quickly. Washington's anti-communist crusade had actually started well before World War II. Just after the Russian Revolution, President Woodrow Wilson chose to join the other imperial powers in helping the white forces attempt to retake control from the Bolshevik revolutionaries. For two reasons. First, the core, foundational American ideology is something like the exact opposite of communism. Strong emphasis is placed on the individual, not the collective, and an idea of freedom that is strongly linked to the right to own things. This had been, after all, the basis for full citizenship in the early American Republic. Only white men with property could vote. And secondly, Moscow presented itself as a geopolitical and ideological rival, an alternative way that poor peoples could rise into modernity without replicating the American experience. But in the years just after World War II, a series of events brought anti-communism to the very center of American politics in an intensely fanatical new form. actually existing anti-communism. It started in Europe, in areas ravaged by World War II. It did not please leaders in Washington that communist parties won the first post-war elections in both France and Italy. In Greece, communist-led guerrillas who had fought the Nazis refused to disarm or recognize the government set up under British supervision, and civil war broke out. Then there was West Asia. In Turkey, the victorious Soviets demanded naval bases at the Strait of Hormuz, sparking a small political crisis. In Iran, the northern half of which had been under Soviet control since 1941, per agreement with the Western Allies, the communist-led Tudeh Party had become the largest and best-organized political group in the country, and ethnic minorities were demanding independence from the Shah, or King, installed by the British. President Truman had much less patience for the Soviet Union than his predecessor, and he was looking for a way to confront Stalin. Greece and Turkey gave it to him. In March 1947, he asked Congress for civilian and military support to those countries in a special address that outlined what would be known as the Truman Doctrine. The very existence of the Greek state is today threatened by the terrorist activities of several thousand armed men led by communists, he said. I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures. Arthur Vandenberg, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, had given some advice to Truman. In order to get what they wanted, the White House had to scare the hell out of the American people about communism. Truman took that advice, and it worked wonders. The anti-communist rhetoric only intensified as the nature of the U.S. political system provided clear incentives for its escalation. After Truman was re-elected in 1948, it just made political sense for the defeated Republican Party to accuse him of being soft on communism, even though he was nothing of the sort. The specific kind of anti-communism that took shape in these years was partly based on value judgments. The widespread belief in the United States that communism was simply a bad system or morally repugnant, even when effective. But it was also based on a number of assertions about the nature of Soviet-led international communism. There was widespread belief that Stalin wanted to invade Western Europe. It became accepted as fact that the Soviets were pushing for revolution worldwide, and that whenever communists were present, even in small numbers, they probably had secret plans to overthrow the government. And it was considered gospel that anywhere communists were acting, they were doing so on the orders of the Soviet Union, part of a monolithic global conspiracy to destroy the West. Most of this was simply untrue. Much of the rest was greatly exaggerated. The case of Greece, the conflict Truman used essentially to launch the Cold War, is an important example. Stalin actually instructed the Greek communists to stand down and let the British-backed government take control after the Nazis left. The Greek communists refused to heed his instructions. Fighting a right-wing government that wanted to annihilate them was more important to them than any loyalty to the Soviet Union. Similarly, the Soviet leader told the Italian and French communists to lay down their arms. They did, and asked Yugoslavia's communist forces to stop supporting their Greek comrades, cede control of their country, and merge with Bulgaria. Yugoslavia's leader, Josip Tito, did not, causing such a huge rift that Stalin tried to kill him. The leaders of Iran's Tudeh Party thought their country was ripe for revolution after World War II, but the Soviets told them to try no such thing, and the USSR had already decided by 1946 that Turkey was not worth the trouble. The Soviet leader had no plans to invade Western Europe. Stalin, of course, did not back off in those parts of the world out of some generosity of spirit or his deep respect for the right of national self-determination. He did so because he had made a deal with the Western powers at Yalta, and he was too afraid of antagonizing the United States to violate it. He was surprised to see that Washington acted as if he had antagonized them anyway. The right-wing Greek government got the backing of the United States, which far preferred a British ally over leftist guerrillas, and employed a chemical called napalm for the first time in history to crush rebels who had fought against Hitler's forces. The Royal Hellenic Air Force dropped the chemical poison over the verdant mountains of the Vitsi region near the Albanian border. In Western Europe, the ancestral home of every U.S. leader to date, Washington introduced the Marshall Plan, a brilliantly designed and magnificently effective economic aid package that put these rich countries on the path to American-style capitalist redevelopment. There existed many currents of socialism, Marxism, and communism in the world, and even parties that were theoretically loyal to the Soviet Union acted independently when they saw fit. And Marxism as a guiding ideology, including in the Marxist-Leninist formulation cemented by Stalin, certainly did not prescribe that everyone everywhere make revolution at all times. In their worldview, you certainly didn't get socialism just because you wanted it. Before Marx himself started writing, there was already a tradition of utopian socialists. One of the main points of Marxism was to reject the idea that you could simply will the world you want into existence, and Marx laid out a theory in which societies moved forward through conflict between economic classes. In the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Friedrich Engels praised capitalism as a revolutionary force, saying that the emergence of the bourgeoisie had liberated humanity from the bonds of feudalism and unleashed powers hitherto unseen. He predicted that the capitalist mode of production would lead to the growth of a working class, which would then overthrow these bourgeois masters in the advanced capitalist countries. This is not how it actually worked out in Europe, but the Soviets still believed in the theory and in the primacy of class development and economic relations. You had to get through capitalism to get to socialism, their theory went. Well before the Russian Revolution, some Marxist parties in Europe, such as the Social Democrats in Germany, rejected the revolutionary path and committed themselves to forwarding the interests of the working class within parliamentary electoral systems. Even among the explicitly pro-Soviet parties in the new Communist International, or Comintern, active from 1919 to 1943, applications of the official ideology varied, and the way that they actually acted was usually based on some combination of the possibilities offered by their local conditions, an interpretation of Marxist orthodoxy, and geopolitical concerns. The case of Mao Zedong in China is an important example. The Comintern provided training to both his Communist Party and the Nationalists, led by Chiang Kai-shek, directing them to organize along Leninist lines, meaning that they would be strictly disciplined and governed by the principle of democratic centralism. The Chinese communists were ordered by Moscow to work directly with the nationalists in a broad, united front, a concept that the Comintern itself had developed. It was believed that because China was such an impoverished peasant society, the country was nowhere near the state of capitalist development that would make revolution possible. The experiences of an older communist party inspired this approach. A Dutchman named Henk Snivlet, the local Comintern boss, had helped found Asia's first Communist Party outside the former Russian Empire, the Indonesian Communist Party, and thought the Chinese Party could learn from the success that Indonesian communists had working with the Islamic Union mass movement. Mao's job was to support the bourgeois nationalists and play a secondary role in the construction of a capitalist nation. A loyal communist, Mao obeyed. This did not work out so well for the Chinese communists. In 1927, Chiang turned on them. Starting with a massacre in Shanghai, nationalist troops killed more than 1 million people, taking aim at communists, peasant leaders, and organizers across the country in a wave of white terror over the next few years. The Chinese communists and the nationalists teamed up again to fight off the occupying Japanese until the end of World War II, and afterward, Stalin ordered the communists to stand down again. In Eastern Europe, Stalin took a very different approach, as he considered this area his rightful sphere of influence because his troops had taken it from Hitler and an important buffer against possible invasion from the West. After the announcement of the Truman Doctrine and the beginning of the Marshall Plan, Moscow engineered a communist coup in Czechoslovakia. The Western powers did not play fair in the territory their armies had occupied either. After it became clear that so many Italians and French wanted to vote freely for communist parties, the U.S. intervened heavily in Western Europe to make sure that the leftists didn't take over. In Paris, the government, which was heavily dependent on U.S. financial aid, ousted all its communist ministers in 1947. In Italy, the U.S. funneled millions of dollars to the Christian Democratic Party and spent millions more on anti-communist propaganda. Big stars like Frank Sinatra and Gary Cooper recorded spots for the U.S. government's Voice of America radio station. Washington organized a huge writing campaign from Italian Americans to friends and relatives back in the home country, with form letters including messages such as a communist victory would ruin Italy, the United States would withdraw aid, and a world war would probably result. And if the forces of true democracy should lose in the Italian election, the American government will not send any more money to Italy. The communists lost. By the end of the 1940s, all of the area that had been liberated by the Red Army consisted of one-party communist states, and all of the area controlled by Western powers was capitalist with a pro-American orientation, regardless of what the people may have wanted in 1945. After a famous Winston Churchill speech, many in the West began to say that Eastern European socialist states were behind an iron curtain. Italian communist leader Palmiro Togliatti, whose party remained popular for decades, said that the United States was a nation led by ignorant slaveholders who now wanted to buy entire nations just as they had bought human beings. Stalin, as a Marxist-Leninist, certainly thought that communism would eventually win. The laws of history made that inevitable, but for that very reason, and because the Soviets had been so weakened by the war, he had no intention of invading Western Europe. He thought that the next world war would break out between the imperialist Western powers, as his own theories seemed to indicate. But in China, Mao decided to ignore Stalin's directives this time, continuing to wage a civil war after the end of World War II. In 1949, he finally defeated the nationalists, whose venality, brutality, and incompetence had long troubled their backers in Washington. Like Ho Chi Minh in August 1945, Mao had also been under the illusion that he could have good relations with the United States. He was wrong, of course. After his victory, the emergency of Red China led to violent recriminations back in the United States. Global McCarthyism. McCarthyism is named after Senator Joseph McCarthy, who led a wild search for communists in the U.S. government in the early 1950s, but it's best understood as a process that started before that man famously began drunkenly berating people in front of the entire nation, and its consequences extended long after he was exposed as a liar. The House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, began its activities in 1938 and only finished in 1975. The famous public trials weren't simply witch hunts, in which mobs went after entities that don't exist. There really were communists in the United States. They were active in labor unions, Hollywood, and some parts of the government, and the Communist Party USA had attracted many black and Jewish members. They were never hugely popular in the 1930s, but what changed after World War II was that communists were no longer welcome at all. McCarthyism was a top-down process, driven especially by the presidency and the FBI. In 1947, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, who had been hugely influential in creating and disseminating the anti-communist consensus, addressed HUAC and gave voice to some of the fundamental assumptions of that ethos. He said that communists planned to organize a military revolt in the country, which would culminate in the extermination of the police forces and the seizure of all communications. He said, "One thing is certain. The American progress, which all good citizens seek, such as old age security, houses for veterans, child assistance, and a host of others, is being deployed as window dressing by the communists to conceal their true aims and entrap gullible followers. The numerical strength of the party's enrolled membership is insignificant. For every party member, there are 10 others ready, willing, and able to do the party's work. There is no doubt as to where a real communist's loyalty rests. Their allegiance is to Russia." Hoover had presented a logical death trap. If anyone accuses you of being communist or communist adjacent, no defense is possible. If you are simply promoting mild social reform, well, that is exactly what a communist would do in order to conceal their true motives. If your numbers are insignificant, that is only further proof of your deviousness, as your comrades are all lurking in the shadows. And if there are a lot of you, or you're openly, proudly communist, that's just as bad. As McCarthyism took off, anything smelling even remotely like communism was expelled from polite American society. A young actor named Ronald Reagan imposed a loyalty oath on all the members of the Screen Actors Guild, the powerful union he led at the time. At the levels of government that mattered, everyone who remained was a fanatical anti-communist, which meant that some of the smartest experts in the State Department, the U.S. diplomatic service, were purged. Because of the loss of China to communism, longtime Asia specialists in particular were accused of harboring left-wing sympathies. As one Brazilian historian puts it, the USA had not invented the ideology, but in the years after World War II, the country was transformed into the global fortress of anti-communism, expending considerable resources on promoting the cause and serving as a reference and source of legitimacy for like-minded movements around the world. By the end of the 1940s, the lines defining the First and Second World had become relatively stable. What was still in flux, however, was the future of the Third World. The Jakarta Axiom. After the Truman Doctrine and the beginning of McCarthyism, there was no question that communists and communist governments were the enemy of Washington. No matter what they hoped for in 1945, Ho Chi Minh and Mao were not going to be welcomed onto the world stage. It was not so clear, on the other hand, what the men running the U.S. government would do with the growing wave of radical Third World movements that were opposed to European imperialism, were not communist, but resisted forming an explicit alliance with Washington against Moscow. This was a very common phenomenon. Many leaders of Third World independence movements associated the United States with its Western European imperialist allies. Others believed the Soviet Union was an important friend in the struggle against colonialism. Even if they did not want to be ruled by the Soviets, they wanted as many allies as they could get. In 1948, the outcome of a small power struggle in the former Dutch East Indies seemed to offer a solution. On the island of Java, independence forces were battling an army that had arrived from the Netherlands in the attempt to reconquer its colonies in Southeast Asia. They had lost this vast archipelago to the Japanese during World War II and refused to recognize the government set up by locals in 1945. During the War of Independence, right-leaning Republican forces clashed with communists within the revolutionary movement around the city of Madiun, East Java. The communists were defeated with the support of independence leader Sukarno, and the head of the Indonesian Communist Party was killed in what became known as the Madiun Affair. The huge nation that Sukarno would go on to lead after the Dutch were finally expelled in 1949, now called Indonesia, was seen as willing enough to put down communist uprisings to be of long-term advantage to the United States. Under Truman, the U.S. foreign policy establishment saw Sukarno's nascent Indonesia as the axiomatic case of a sufficiently anti-communist, anti-colonial movement, and so the name of its capital, Jakarta, came to signify this principle of tolerance for neutral Third World nations. As Cold War historian Odd Arne Westad put it, Washington adopted the Jakarta Axiom. This position was not very stable, nor were the real-world actions of the United States satisfactory to the leaders of the new Third World. A young congressman from Massachusetts named John F. Kennedy had the curiosity, ambition, and money to travel the world trying to get an idea of their attitudes, and what he got was an earful. Jack Kennedy, or JFK, was a rare bird among the U.S. elite. He was a Catholic, and he was much more than the first Irish Brahmin. He was the first member of American royalty to descend from the masses of people who had come to the country as impoverished immigrants rather than as colonizers. His father, Joseph Kennedy, had fought prejudice and probability to build a huge fortune in finance and real estate, and by the time young Jack went off to fight in World War II, he had been on a grand tour of Europe, swung through most of South America, and graduated from Harvard. Joe Kennedy understood one fundamental truth about political power in the United States. You can buy it. He spent a staggering sum on Jack's 1946 congressional race, according to one of his cousins. He told two reporters, "Politics is like war. It takes three things to win. The first is money, and the second is money, and the third is money." Joe's assistant liked to hand out cash in public toilets just to be on the safe side. Jack, who, like his father, was considered a playboy by those who knew him, won easily. But U.S. politics can't run on money alone. He did also need to maintain public support. The nature of his working-class Catholic constituency pushed him a bit to the liberal side of the aisle, however, into an alliance with those who had supported Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal. but Jack certainly had no time for the Reds. During his first campaign, he said, "The time has come when we must speak plainly on the great issue facing the world today. The issue is Soviet Russia." He saw labor unions as self-serving and infiltrated by communists and let their members know it in congressional hearings. And in 1954, when a special Senate committee recommended that Joseph McCarthy be condemned for breaking Senate rules, John F. Kennedy was the only Democrat not to vote against him. However, perhaps because he was so well-traveled, or perhaps because he was Irish and knew in some very small way what it felt like to come from a people who had been oppressed somewhere, JFK viewed the Third World differently from most of the Washington elites. While so many others saw any deviation from an explicit alliance with the U.S. as communist subversion of the global order, JFK believed that emerging nations were insisting on their right to forge their own path, and that this was entirely understandable. In 1951, he went on a trip to Morocco, Iran, Egypt, Indochina, Malaya, Burma, India, and Pakistan, and came to the conclusion that the United States had failed to understand the importance of nationalistic passions directed primarily against the colonial policies of the West. Later that year, he went on another one of his long jaunts, this time to Israel, Iran, Pakistan, Singapore, French, Indochina, Korea, Japan, and Indonesia. He observed that the U.S. was definitely classed with the imperialist powers of Europe. Washington desperately needed to align with the emerging nations, but that was difficult because Americans were more and more becoming colonialists in the minds of the people. Reflecting on the situation in Vietnam, he reported that the United States had allied ourselves to the desperate effort of a French regime to hang on to the remnants of empire. He said, "If one thing was born into me as a result of my experience in the Middle as well as the Far East, it is that communism cannot be met effectively by merely the force of arms." But it was in India that Jack and his brother Bobby really got a lecture from one of the world's new class of leaders. Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first prime minister, like Gamal Abdel Nasser, who came to power in Egypt in 1952, favored the construction of a socialist society. Both these leaders rejected the Leninist model and wanted to forge their own path, but when push came to shove, they often preferred to align with the Soviets rather than with the Americans and their European allies. Even if he had known about the worst tragedies of the 1930s in the Soviet Union, it would be hard to blame Nehru for distrusting the Western powers. During World War II, British policies created a famine that took the lives of 4 million people. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill blamed the Indians for the famine his own government caused, saying it was their fault for breeding like rabbits, and asked why Gandhi, whom Churchill loathed, hadn't died yet. When Jack and two younger siblings dined with Nehru in 1951, the Indian leader was imperious, acting bored and unimpressed, and only showed interest in their sister Pat, Bobby Kennedy reported. When JFK asked Nehru about Vietnam, the Indian leader dismissed the French war as an example of doomed colonialism and said the U.S. was pouring its aid money down a bottomless hole. He gently lectured the Kennedys, as if he were speaking to children, and Bobby wrote down in his notes in an exasperated tone that Nehru told them communism offered the people of the Third World something to die for. Bobby continued jotting down Nehru's comments in his journal. "We Americans have only status quo to offer these people." Smiling Jones and Wisner's Weirdos. As the United States woke up to its position of unprecedented global power, there were a few ways its government could interact with the rest of the world. The president was in charge of the Department of War, or the Pentagon, which soon became the Department of Defense. There was the State Department, the U.S. Foreign Ministry and Diplomatic Service, which had been in operation since 1789. But there was no dedicated spy service. There was no permanent institution engaged in gathering information abroad and licensed to carry out secret operations, covert action seeking to change the course of events around the world. The Americans did not have the centuries of experience running a global empire the British did, or even the experience of ongoing self-defensive spycraft the Soviets inherited from the Russian Empire. But Washington created a new intelligence agency very quickly, using the country's vast wealth to fund it generously, and young men who cut their teeth abroad during World War II to staff it. One of the most important new hires was Frank Wisner, who had a story he would tell every time he was trying to explain why he did what he did for the United States government. Wisner had flown into Romania in September 1944 to work as station chief for the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, the temporary spy agency that Washington set up during the war. Once there, he heard and believed that the Soviets were scheming to take control of the country, but his bosses back home were in no mood to hear that their allies were up to no good. In January 1945, Stalin ordered that thousands of men and women of German descent be taken back to the Soviet Union to be mobilized for work. Wisner knew some of them personally. As the forced evacuation began, he rode frantically around the city, as he told it, trying to save them. But he failed. Thousands of people were herded onto boxcars and sent to labor camps. According to his family, those scenes would haunt him for the rest of his troubled life. Wisner, sometimes just called Wiz, was born in 1909 to a wealthy family with a lot of land in Missouri, one of the states in the U.S. South governed by Jim Crow laws, which discriminated against African Americans. He grew up in an insular, privileged household. As a child, he didn't even put on his own clothes. He would lie down, raise his arms and legs, and his black maid would put his shirt and trousers on for him. Frank's favorite book was Kim by Rudyard Kipling, which told its story against the backdrop of the great game between the British-Russian empires. Wiz was sent off to the aristocratic Woodbury Forest School in Virginia. He desperately lifted weights to add bulk to his wiry frame and was intensely competitive. At the University of Virginia, he was tapped to join the Sevens, a secret society so baroque that it only revealed the names of its members at their death. He was intense, but could come alive, especially at parties liberally lubricated with alcohol. Wiz became a lawyer at a white shoe firm on Wall Street. Restless and driven by an intense sense of moral purpose, he enlisted in the Navy a year before the Japanese attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor. The OSS liked to hire elite corporate lawyers from the best schools, and Wisner fit the bill. He got into the intelligence service with the help of an old professor and took to the life like a fish to water. In Romania, he wasn't only gathering information and attempting to save Germans, he was hobnobbing with royalty, drinking and dancing, living in a mansion, and doing magic tricks. He was also socializing alongside the more experienced Soviet agents. After he left Romania, it became clear that Russian spies had infiltrated his entire operation. Back on Wall Street after the war, Wisner was once more bored and listless, so he jumped at the opportunity to serve his country again and to fight the communists. He took over a new covert operations organization, innocuously named the Office of Policy Coordination, OPC, and began activities in Berlin. At the same time, a very different man named Howard Palfrey Jones, working in the opposite arm of the U.S. foreign policy apparatus, arrived in Berlin, along with Alan Dulles, Wisner's old OSS boss. Jones was a diplomat and a veteran who had witnessed the brutality of German National Socialism early. On a trip to Germany in 1934, he was beaten by Nazi soldiers because he failed to salute the Nazi flag properly. He was already a grown man when World War II started and served in Germany. Immediately after the war, he entered the State Department. Unlike Wisner, who was a diehard crusader, Jones had an entirely different approach to the rest of the world. Rather than viewing every situation in terms of a black and white global struggle, he sought to engage deeply with the complexities of each situation, and he was having a great time. In almost every picture taken of him, Howard Palfrey Jones looks like a big, good-natured goofball. He has a wide grin on his face, looking just very pleased to be there, whether among Javanese dancers or rubbing elbows with fellow diplomats. His contemporaries described him in similar terms. He would strut around the world in white sharkskin suits, doing his best to use the local language and make friends with everyone. Even those who considered him an enemy, that is, the communists, called him Smiling Jones and warned comrades not to be taken in by his wholesome demeanor. Jones was born into a middle-class family in Chicago in 1899. The city was bustling and chaotic, and he grew up causing all kinds of trouble with a mix of kids, sons of immigrants from Poland, Italy, Bohemia, and Norway in the neighborhood. By global standards, his childhood was an absolute dream, but compared to the likes of Wisner and Kennedy, he was just a regular guy. and when asked later in life to describe the experience he was most proud of, he went straight to the time he tried to take on racism in the U.S. After college at the University of Wisconsin, he became a newspaper editor in Evansville, Indiana. The paper found that the Ku Klux Klan, a brutal white supremacist organization, was running a web of criminal activities and controlled the police. The editors prepared an exposé, and the KKK Grand Eagle called to threaten Jones directly. He ran the story anyway, and the Klan burned crosses throughout the town. Half the paper's advertisers pulled out of the paper. The State Department was different from the hard-charging outfits Wisner worked for, but even compared to most diplomats at State, Jones was especially engaged and empathetic. He was called, perhaps a bit dismissively, the master of the soft sell, which meant that he presented the official position of the U.S. government as gently as possible. For him, foreign policy had to be based on deep knowledge of what the local people wanted, and this meant that no one-size-fits-all approach could work. He certainly believed it was acceptable for Washington to try to change the world and pursue its own interests, but how could you do so without understanding each culture on its own terms? In Berlin in 1948, Jones and Wisner were both working on the big issue of the day in Germany, financial affairs and the divided country. Wisner pressed hard for an adversarial stance toward Moscow. He supported the creation of a new currency in the Western occupied areas. In June 1948, the Allied governments decided to unilaterally issue a currency for West Germany, the Deutschmark, catching the Soviets off guard and likely forcing the long-term split of the country into two. Afterward, Jones was sent to work in Taiwan, where Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists had set up a government. Because they refused to recognize Mao's communist government on the mainland, the U.S. government recognized this as the real China, even though Taiwan had its own population and identity before they arrived. This was no democracy. In February 1947, the new government massacred thousands of people opposed to nationalist rule, beginning another period of white terror and intermittent repression of dissidents, often justified on anti-communist grounds, that continued for years. By 1951, Wisner's OPC had been absorbed into a newly formed permanent organ called the Central Intelligence Agency, and his title had become Deputy Director of Plans. Wiz was the man in charge of clandestine operations. His team, often called his Gang of Weirdos elsewhere in Washington, started looking for ways to fight the Cold War, in secret, around the world, however they could. Wisner was a real blue blood, but most of the ranks of the early CIA were from an even higher strata of American society. Many were Yale men, of the type who would look down on other Yale men if they didn't come from the right boarding school or enter the right secret society. But when it came to anti-communism, Wiz had most of them beat. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who was an OSS sergeant in Germany, said, "I myself was no great admirer of the Soviet Union, and I certainly had no expectations of harmonious relations after the war, but Frank was a little excessive, even for me." The CIA boys and their wives built a lively social life around Washington, D.C. More urbane and liberal than most people in that city at the time, they would organize spirited dinner parties at their houses in Georgetown. They'd invite over CIA agents, defense officials, and influential journalists. After the meal, the women would retire to one room, while the men talked politics in another, which was the style at the time. They also liked to get very drunk, just like James Bond. As a matter of fact, they looked up to the Secret Intelligence Service, or MI6, the British agency that had accumulated so much expertise in spycraft while maintaining the British Empire for centuries. And some of them loved James Bond himself. Tracy Barnes, one of the agency's founding figures, loved the character created by Ian Fleming in 1953 and would pass out copies of the novels to his family at Thanksgiving. Paul Nitze, the man who wrote the so-called Blueprint of the Cold War, described the upper-class imperial values that children soaked up at the Groton School, a private school which was on elite English public schools and gave the CIA many of its key early members. In history, every religion has greatly honored those members who destroyed the enemy. The Quran, Greek mythology, the Old Testament, Groton boys were taught that, said Nitze. Doing in the enemy is the right thing to do. Of course, there are some restraints on ends and means. If you go back to Greek culture and read Thucydides, there are limits to what you can do to other Greeks who are a part of your culture, but there are no limits to what you can do to a Persian. He's a barbarian. The communists, he concluded, were barbarians. From the beginning, the CIA had two basic divisions. On one side was the gathering of intelligence through espionage. Their job was something akin to providing a private news service for the president. On the other side was covert action, the rough stuff, the active attempts to change the world. That was Frank Wisner's territory. Wiz started out by building a network of spies and stay-behind agents in Western Europe whose job was to rise to action if the Soviets ever did invade. In Germany, the CIA had no problem recruiting former Nazis, including those who had run death squads, as long as they were anti-communist. Then, Wisner looked for a way to penetrate Soviet territory. He recruited desperate, homeless Ukrainian refugees, many of whom had fought with the Nazis, to parachute into communist territory and revolt against the Russians. None of them survived, but that didn't stop Wisner. The agency sent hundreds of Albanian agents back to their homeland. Almost all were captured or killed. It almost seemed as if the Soviet-aligned government was waiting for them. They were. Kim Philby, a British agent who worked closely alongside Wisner and the rest of the CIA, had been a Soviet mole the whole time. Almost every single one of Wisner's early operations had been compromised somehow. Wisner sent more men into Albania even after he found this out. They were caught and put on trial. Slowly but surely, Wiz and the CIA boys realized that actual Soviet territory was mostly rock solid. They were certainly failing to penetrate it. If they wanted to fight communism, and they did, very badly, they had to look elsewhere. The Third World offered that opportunity. The problem these men overlooked, according to a mostly sympathetic history written by journalist Evan Thomas, was the fact that they knew almost nothing about the so-called developing world.